What if one conversation could save a life? What if one new process or new product could save a patient from surgical harm? Broadcasting from a hospital basement near you, you are listening to the Beyond Clean podcast, the global voice of sterile processing. Each week we spotlight the best practices, products and people from around the world who are disrupting our profession and helping you fight dirty. Every instrument, every time. Join us as we have the kinds of conversation that matter and give our industry the kind of voice that it deserves. Nyt on aika mennä puhdastakin puhtaammaksi. And now it's time to go beyond clean.
This week on Beyond Clean, we speak with Don Tuminelli, who is the Senior Technical Manager of Client Services at High Power Labs. Don has over 13 years of experience in the medical device industry and is an expert in sterilization, including both single-use and reusable device validations. Mike, we're going to be talking mostly about reusable device validations on today's show, but single-use validations, maybe we'll have Don come back in the future. It ties to an interview that we had with Dan Vukelich in season one. But I think the biggest thing is I'm really excited to kick off season two because our listeners have been waiting for 5 weeks. I know we released our top five downloaded shows from season one. And from now on, our seasons are going to be 8 episodes each, not 52 episodes as it was in our very first year. But we're also offering CEU credits to the listeners of the podcast. Then they're going to fill out some sort of an online exam to be able to get that CEU certificate. So more info coming on that, but really excited for season two, and I'm glad Don's going to be kicking it off with us.
Yeah, this is going to be a really good episode. I know there's a lot of questions, a lot of misunderstanding when it comes to the whole validation, that whole question of validation, the IFU writing process. And so we're going to do what we do here at Beyond Clean, and we're going to go right to the source. We're going to ask an expert, and we're going to get some clear-cut answers, and I'm really looking forward to this one.
HealthMark has intelligent solutions for your cleaning verification program, including products to measure water temperature, water quality, cleaning efficacy, and to directly test for residual soil left on instruments. Find your tools for cleaning verification at hmark.com. There you will learn about our TOSI and SonoCheck that test the performance of mechanical washers as recommended in sterilization standards guidelines. Other products like CartWash Check test for mechanical efficiency and target temperature. The ProCheck 2 can detect residual protein to a very low level. Go to hmark.com today for all of your cleaning verification testing needs.
It's 2023 and there's big news for IST, a closed warning letter, a new product launch, and a 10-year anniversary. OneTray IST has a lot to celebrate this year. OneTray's 2006 cleared 48-hour storage claim was acknowledged by the FDA, and the company is pushing forward, offering the total solution for reprocessing. OneTray maximizes reprocessing time. EasyTrax adds flexibility with instrument organization, and their upcoming product, OneCart, a sealed case cart with a smaller footprint and a perfect option for off-site sterilization, completes the total solution. Experience a year of efficiency with OneTray. For more information on the closure of the warning letter, visit OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. That's OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. Otherwise, you can reach out to the company by calling 937-619-0138 or visit OneTray.com/contact.
Beyond Clean. Joining us now is Don Tuminelli, who is the Senior Technical Manager of Client Services at High Power Labs. And we're kicking off Season 2, Don, so thank you very much. We've been talking about having you on for a while. I'm glad our schedule's lined up because I know that the listeners want to learn more about medical device validation.
Sure. Happy to be here, guys, and definitely have listened to a few of your shows in the past, and I'm a fan, and I really like what I hear. So I'd be more than happy to give you a little education on validation labs and more. How's that?
That's great. And I would think probably we just start from the beginning, give an introduction to validation labs. What are they? What do you do? I know there's a difference between both single-use and reusable device validations. We're obviously going to talk mostly about reusable device validations today, but it might not be a bad idea to describe the differences between the two as well.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, today's topic, definitely reusable validations. So when I think of validation labs, in the world of medical devices, I think of microbiologists, I think of toxicologists and chemists, okay? Those types of scientists can pretty much cover the gamut of different tests you would need to bring a device to market. In the case of most class 2 medical devices, which require a 510K, the types of testing that you would really be looking for are mainly going to be biocompatibility testing to make sure that the device is compatible with the body. And then there's the, of course, the sterilization validations, which demonstrate that the device is indeed sterile, and cleaning validations, which I'm sure most of us are aware of is a very, very big topic these days.
So, Don, that's a great overview of a lab. And for sterile processing technicians in particular, obviously our world is in the hospital setting and we're on the back end of everything that is accomplished in that lab. But can you walk through, maybe help us visualize, if you were to step into a typical medical device validation lab, what equipment are you going to see in the lab? What services are there and available to customers? And I guess the fundamental question there is, who are your customers? Like, who comes to medical validation lab asking for services?
Okay, great. Be more than happy to talk about that. The customer most likely in this instance is going to be the medical device manufacturer themselves. So those are the people that are designing these devices and trying to bring them to market and sell them. So those are our customers. So think of the medical device companies that hospitals use every day, the names on the packages. I won't name any in particular. Many of you know who these big name companies are. It all starts typically with a phone call. They will give us a ring and tell us what they're looking for. And then part of our job to guide them down the right road and the right path, because sometimes they have no idea exactly what they need for their device. For instance, customer or client comes to us, it's a medical device manufacturer, and they have, say it's a new Ronjour or something down that line. Definitely class 2 medical device. It's going to require an instructions for use to be supplied with the device when it's sold to the hospital. The instructions for use is going to be required by the FDA to have a section in there that specifically outlines how that device is to be cleaned and sterilized. And then that leads us to developing the protocols to do the testing. Now, if you were to then walk into our lab, you would see very similar equipment that a hospital central service department would have. You're going to see very similar sterilizers. You're going to see the same washer disinfectors, the same ultrasonication machines, packaging systems. In particular, our lab, we have actually set our lab up to mimic a central service department. When you walk into our lab, if you are a CS technician, you're going to be very familiar with what you're seeing very quickly. And the reason for that is for conducting these studies, we want to conduct those studies as realistically as possible. And having, you know, a laboratory that mimics a CS department allows us to reproduce that testing as realistically as possible. So once again, the customer is the medical device manufacturer. The equipment is very similar to what you'd see in a CS department.
Well, that kind of brings up a question then. If the equipment is the same as what we would normally see in a sterile processing department, are there any sort of controls that imitate the pressures that a sterile processing technician might be under, as in, you know, having to do more than just one device, but having to do multiple devices under a certain time crunch? Or is that just beyond the ability to imitate?
Okay, that's a great question. I think part of that question revolves around the world of validation versus verification, okay? Labs typically validate, hospitals and CS departments verify. Even though the equipment is the same, it's really the technique of validating the device that is really specific. So once again, the equipment might be identical because the FDA does ask that the equipment being used to validate the medical device falls under the same 510K as the sterilizers. I hope I didn't lose anyone there. What I want to let everyone know is that sterilizers themselves are 510K approved medical devices. And because of that, the FDA does want us to use the same sterilizers that are used in the hospitals, okay? But that brings us back to the question, if we have the same equipment as a hospital, then why can't a hospital validate? And maybe that's a road we're traveling down, just to make sure I'm on the right path there.
Yes, and also it's very common for us to kind of talk about the difficulty with following IFUs being that the instructions were created in a lab in a very controlled environment, whereas the if you've ever been in the decontamination area, particularly of a sterile processing department, it is very much not a calm and controlled environment sometimes. I guess the question then is how much of an imitation it can be. Is there a one-to-one comparison between the lab and the SPD in a hospital as far as the what's actually being performed in cleaning the device?
Right. Okay, so cleaning. Okay, so we'll talk about cleaning. Yeah. One of the things we do in the lab, it is controlled to a certain extent, but one of the things we do is we actually develop the studies under worst-case conditions. For cleaning, that could mean that if we look at an IFU and it says to use a certain detergent, instead of using the detergent exactly as the manufacturer recommends, such as the concentration, we would actually shave back and use least effective concentration. So our concentration would be weaker, per se, than what the hospital would use. And the purpose of that is to demonstrate that under worst case conditions, we still achieve a certain acceptance criteria to conclude that the device is indeed clean. So that's where the control comes in, is we will design our tests with worst case conditions. Whereas the hospitals per se are running the washer disinfectors under nominal conditions. So that's set by the manufacturer. We do have a little liberty and we do have ways of designing our studies to be worst case for the validation testing.
So Don, I want to pick back up on a train of thought that you mentioned earlier in distinguishing between what a laboratory does in validating a device and what a user hospital does in verifying a device. Can you talk on that verification side? What does that mean and what does it look like in the hospital setting?
Sure. Okay. So verification, remember, like I said, in the hospitals, you are running the nominal parameters, the ones that were recommended by the manufacturer of the washer disinfector or the sterilizer per se. Whereas in the lab, we're cutting back on those and running worst case. I'll give you a great example. In the lab, when we validate a sterilization cycle, and I'm going to use the most common cycle out there, that's the pre-vacuum steam, 132 degrees Celsius, 4-minute cycle. Almost everyone should be aware of that. I think every hospital in the U.S. has the capability of running that cycle. In the hospital, you are running a 4-minute exposure. In the lab, for our validation, we run a 2-minute exposure. So it's half of lethality, okay? So we are controlling that in the lab. Another thing that we're controlling in the lab is before we put that device in the sterilizer for the 2-minute half cycle, we are actually inoculating the device with 1 million spores of the worst case organism for the steam sterilization process. So we're literally inoculating the device with 1 million spores. And not only using 1 million, but we're putting them in the most difficult to sterilize location of that device. So like I said, everything is designed worst case. And that's where the control comes in. The control comes in, we are really focusing on that worst case area. We are putting the bugs in that worst case area, and we know that there's 1 million bugs on there because we actually count the bugs. I won't get into all that, but yeah, there's a lot of counting that goes in our lab every day. People,
tweezers,
that's all
right?
They do.
You pick them off with tweezers and count them one at a time.
Yeah, we have them all stand up in a little row, and then we count them.
So let me ask you a question about that. Let's say you've got an instructions for use, right? And it says you're going to use this enzymatic, like you just talked about. But then you're testing at a different lower level or not as good necessarily condition. In that scenario, correct, when the manufacturer writes that instructions for use, maybe they reference their own enzymatic that they manufacture as well, right? If they do that, are you impossible? Okay.
No, it is possible that they do that. They could, the one that they want in there. So right now the FDA, they're not requiring you to put in a specific brand name of detergent in your IFU. What the FDA expects now is that you point out the category of the detergent. And when I say category, I mean they want to know, was it a pH neutral enzymatic? Was it a non-enzymatic? Was it an alkaline? So those are the things the FDA expects you to point out in your IFU for the detergent. Getting specific about the brand, they also like you to put in parentheses, for example, then you can put the brand that you used. And there's a reason for that. So you're not tied
to the brand legally is what I want to get at. I think it's important because I think there are people out there that'll read the instructions for use and think, oh, this manufacturer used their enzymatic and thus –
correct,
we cannot simulate the process without using that brand of enzymatic. And obviously, I would think that that's too limiting and too restrictive. But I know that there is at least one person who's going to listen to this episode who thought that that's how the IFU works until they
correct. Yeah. No, I'm glad you brought that up. It is an area of confusion. So here's the reason why the name of the detergent is in a lot of these IFUs. And if you look closely, it typically is in parentheses as an example only. Was it the one that was used during the validation? Most likely, yes, it probably was. But it's not per se pointing you down that road that you have to use that. Okay, so if you were to ask FDA today, they're not going to tell you to use the specific brand. Once again, it's to make sure if the IFU says neutral enzymatic pH detergent, parentheses, Ferrosilicic or something, right? Close parentheses. What it's saying, what the FDA wants the take-home message to be is that you use a pH-neutral enzymatic. The only reason the FDA is asking people to put the parentheses in as an example is to give the users some kind of guidance so that they can go out and purchase it. Because what they found out in the past, if there was nothing in there, they found out that it was more difficult for users to find what they need. So it's just kind of like staring you down a road, but it's not per se telling you you have to use that one.
So going back to the hospital side of things, is there such a way as self-validation that hospitals can sort of come up with their own parameters? Is there any sort of world where that is possible?
Well, anything is possible. And yes, if a hospital wanted to go to that level, they probably could. But they're going to have to hire staff and put in systems they probably don't have in place, such as microbiologists, maybe toxicologists. If they wanted to go to that level, they could. But I'm going to tell you right now, they're not in the most hospitals aren't in business to do that. I wouldn't think there'd be a hospital out there would have part of their business plan was to validate devices. However, there are hospitals out there where Dr. X walks in the door one morning and he has this new device that he whipped up in his garage the night before. That happens. And I get those calls all the time from hospitals.
I've been there. I've been in that exact situation.
A lot of times they will call us and we can do the validation. And it gives them some data. And some data sometimes is better than no data. So it's all based on the risk analysis of the hospital, how far they want to take it. But I guess if there's a hospital where they're in that arena where they seem to be coming up with new devices all the time, maybe they do want to put in their own little department that has the expertise to do validation. But like I said, it is a little controlled. I didn't give you all the details. But it's not only controlling the bugs and putting them on the device, it's also recovering them, culturing them. It is a lot of microbiology. Could a hospital do it? They probably could if they wanted to take it to that level. Most, I would suspect, probably would not.
So kind of piggybacking along with that, is there kind of a definition, I say, for how loose a hospital can be with sterilization parameters and still be compliant?
Such as if they change their parameters? Is that what you're saying?
Some hospitals may want to do it 30 seconds longer, maybe 30 seconds shorter. You know, we mentioned before that the most common is a 270 Fahrenheit with 4 minute sterilization. But then we see that every now and then you'll find an IFU for a company that specifies 5 minutes, not 4 minutes. And if you miss that, you know, is that, have you performed something off label at that point?
Yeah, I mean, that happened, and it was a really, really big problem about a decade ago, before the FDA really came up with this list of what they consider to be traditional cycles today. So if you go back, 10 years ago, there were lots of IFUs out there with 8-minute cycles, 10-minute cycles, some even longer than that. And what was happening was people were putting the wrong devices in the wrong cycles. For instance, a device that was validated for 8 minutes could very easily be put in a 4-minute cycle by accident. And if that did happen, there is a potential that the device was not sterile. The other way around, let's just say you had a device that was validated for 270 for 4 minutes and you put it in the 8-minute cycle. Well, now you have 4 minutes extra exposure on the device, which could degrade the device to a point where maybe it's not functional anymore. Maybe it falls apart faster or doesn't last as long. So you can go both sides of the spectrum. One is the two big take-home messages, obviously, is sterilization. Is it sterile? And that has to do with the time, the 4 minutes exposure. Anything less than 4 minutes, sterility could be compromised. Anything longer than 4 minutes, the functionality of the device might be compromised. So the two big things to look for is sterility and then functionality.
So Don, that brings up a great question. We're actually in season two, we're going to do an entire episode on sterilizing of flexible endoscopes. But you mentioned earlier that part of the testing these validation labs do is with biocompatibility. And as an expert in this field, how close are we with the current products on the market in terms of sterilization techniques, and then also the current products on the market for these flexible scopes? Is there an issue with maintaining that functionality through our current sterilization methods, or are we there and it just takes some tweaking with the way that we do the testing or the way that we write the IFUs? I mean, I think a lot of folks have kind of been sitting in the background watching this happening. There's been a couple of facilities out there, you know, taking the first step, but there's a lot of questions. So what's your perspective on that?
No, this is a really, really good topic. Yeah, endoscopes. A lot of these endoscopes out there, these flexible endoscopes, have historically, a lot of them have only needed to achieve high-level disinfection. However, a lot of the manufacturers now are starting to look at sterilization validation. But why are we high-level disinfecting this? Let's take it to the next level. Let's just sterilize the device. So we're experiencing quite a bit of that now with some of these manufacturers. And hopefully I'm on the right track here and I didn't get off track. But if I am, what we're seeing is that taking it to the sterilization level does create a whole new set of challenges, such as, what are your choices when you get into the world of sterilization with an endoscope? Well, steam most likely is going to be out because it's so high temperature. You're going to have problems with your epoxies. You're going to have problems with your polymer components of the scope. That's the components that make the scope flexible. These good, nice polymers, right? They just don't do good in steam. So what are you left with? Usually a low temperature alternative is your choice. Now, the one that for years people have used was ethylene oxide. Now, we know that there's very few and far between ethylene oxide sterilizers around. However, it does seem to be one of the best choices right now for these scopes if you don't want to redesign them. Hydrogen peroxide works for some of them, and it's great. The hydrogen peroxide process is excellent. But some of these devices that haven't been redesigned to be compatible with hydrogen peroxide are now left with nothing more than ethylene oxide. We're seeing this as a challenge. I think a lot of these scope manufacturers eventually will redesign their scopes to be compatible with the hydrogen peroxide processes, because as we know, there's a number of them out there today.
Don, this was an incredibly engaging episode. And even then, you talk about all of that. And I'm just going to throw a shout out to a previous episode with David Hilliker from ChemDAC. And there's a whole other exposure conversation there as well, and monitoring exposure. But this was really engaging. I think the interview went very quickly. And I wanted to thank you for coming on the show and doing such an amazing job of really explaining the process to the listeners and hitting a couple of hot buttons and clarifying the difference between validation and verification and some of the other things related to IFUs that I think everybody has always wondered. These questions come up at a lot of conferences and seminars across the country around the year. And it's really great to have you on and be able to clarify some of those things.
Yeah, sure. No, it was my pleasure. Anytime.
That was Don Tuminelli. He's the Senior Technical Manager of Client Services at High Power Labs. And Hank, this was a great way to kick off season two. I really enjoyed getting into the weeds a little bit. I did think it was very important to make that distinction between validation and verification. But also, I can't tell you how many times people have said that they've read an IFU, it's mentioned a specific product, and they don't feel like they have any choice or options in the matter. And I think that's ludicrous. I don't think that anybody would ever be able to tell you which enzymatic you have to use to process their device. And I'm glad Don kind of cleared up some of that confusion as well.
That's right, Justin. And I really appreciated the insight that Don was able to give the listeners on just what are these mysterious validation labs out there. Like when folks think laboratory, you know, we're thinking white coats with microscopes and little pipettes, you know. And obviously, there is a lot of that. He alluded to how they know that they're putting 1 million microbes on these devices. So obviously, there is some very high-tech testing. On the other side, there is a real attempt to mirror the challenges and the workflow of a traditional sterile processing department to get this right, because they do realize what they're doing. They're validating these devices to be used and for the process to be repeatable in the real world on the front lines. And I thought he did a great job of outlining why that's necessary and how that's done. And as you said, why that is different from the kinds of testing that's done on the user side. This is one of those episodes, Justin, where we could have gone on for an hour and still not run out of material, but another reason to bring him back sometime down the road, talk some more of these pervasive myths out there as it relates to validation.
Yeah, absolutely. We talked about it right after we got done recording the interview with Don, and we used to have two segments, but it went an hour, and really podcasting is meant to be in that 20 to 25 minute range. The great news for us is we can bring Don back on for future conversations on other topics, because at some point when we get to season like 10 and 12 of Beyond Clean, if we're lucky enough to go that long, we are going to have to go back to the well of experts that have helped make this show great. So on that note, that's going to do it for this week's show. As a reminder, you can help support us by subscribing to Beyond Clean on iTunes or Stitcher, and now also on Google Play and Spotify. Simply search for Beyond Clean Podcast. We'd appreciate a rating and a review because your feedback is important to the show. And if you have any topics that you'd like us to cover on a future episode, or if you'd like to share a picture anonymously on our Instagram page, just send an email to info@beyondclean.net. On behalf of Hank, Mike, and myself, thank you for listening to another edition of Beyond Clean.